I'm Bill Anderson, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. HIV and AIDS researchers are finding lots of reasons to be cautiously optimistic these days. That's because many professionals believe we can end the HIV epidemic. Treatment and biomedical prevention, among other efforts, are more advanced. While optimism was expressed at last week's International AIDS Conference, the fact remains about 34 million people are HIV positive, including more than 6,000 in Kansas City. Today we talk to Kansas City researchers about their work around the globe, living HIV positive in Kansas City, and this defining moment in the battle against HIV and AIDS. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Bill Anderson. Steve Kraske is away. The world has reached a defining moment in the battle against HIV/AIDS. The battle cry coming from the just-completed International AIDS Conference, we now have the potential to end the epidemic. But the potential can become the reality only if the many stakeholders play their roles. Roles related to public policy, money, science, and medicine, and the people affected by HIV, and their families, of course. Later this hour, a view of HIV/AIDS in the Kansas City community. But first, let's talk about the International Conference and what's playing out on a global basis. Joining us, Kathy Goggin. Kathy's Curator's Professor of Psychology at UMKC. She directs the HIV/AIDS Research Group. Good morning.
Morning.
Nice to have you here. And joining us is Dr. Sarah Finicario. She's with the KU Med Center Department of Family Medicine, and you're also a fellow with the HIV/AIDS Research Group.
Yes. Good morning.
It's very nice to have you here. Well,
let's
start with the international conference. Kathy, what is your takeaway?
Yeah, I think I'm going to kick to Sarah because she was actually able to be there and have boots on ground.
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
Okay, thanks. It's always exciting to get a chance to go to the International AIDS Conference, and I think really for two reasons. It's really mentally stimulating and that they're presenting a lot of new science, particularly this conference. We had a lot of great new science to discuss, but it also is emotionally stimulating. It's one of the conferences where you have a chance to really hear from people who are living with HIV, who are being incredible leaders in their community, you know, advocates that are really pushing this agenda and making things happen. So working with HIV, it's really rewarding for me to get to go and be sort of re-energized in that way.
Why so much promise coming out of this, however? Is it because of the science?
Yes, we've had, I mean, in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, we've had several breakthroughs in prevention research. And so we've made a lot of progress, and we have a lot of tools that are now available to us, and we can discuss them more in detail. But with this, there's just growing enthusiasm in the field of HIV prevention and treatment. And we have a lot of sort of high-level backing of this enthusiasm. And we saw that by having Secretary of State Hillary Clinton there strongly promoting this, setting the goals to eliminating HIV, you know, terminology we hadn't used before. But there are a lot of high-level people from the United States that really wanted to throw their support behind this, and not just verbally, but really some promise of additional financial support, too, to try to capitalize on these new scientific findings.
And there are so many. I mean, it's obviously a global problem, and it's got to be a huge challenge to bring these people to the table at a conference like this and to maybe perhaps not duplicate what others are doing across the Atlantic Ocean, for example. Is that kind of the gist of why we have this International AIDS Conference, to pull everyone together, the stakeholders, so to speak?
It really is. And I mean, it's a global epidemic. And mm-hmm. so we need all people involved. And there's 159 countries represented at this conference, over 20,000 delegates. It was really exciting, and it gives that international feel. And I think really the theme, I mean, when you got off the metro stops in D.C., it was plastered with these signs that said, you know, together we are greater than HIV. And I think that that's really part of the theme. To capitalize on these new advancements, we need everybody to buy in and everybody to play their role in that.
Kathy, you weren't at the conference, but obviously you're well informed, and you've probably talked to Sarah at length about the takeaways from the conference. Where do we go from here? What are the strong points? What gives us the advantage if we're looking to prevent this epidemic?
Well, I think one of the things that's really come forth in the last few years has been effective treatments that are less pills per day, so they're much more takeable. People can adhere to them better. Reductions in costs of medications, and also a World Health Organization change in their platform of moving people onto medication earlier in their disease course.
Now, I read somewhere, I think it was on NPR.org, that costs can range, however, from $2,000 to $5,000 per month for someone who's treating, being treated for HIV.
So in the States, we have a great variance, and I know we're going to bring on another expert halfway through who is even knows a heck of a lot more than I do. But I can tell you that the costs in the States are different than they are overseas. And so the cheapest regimen offered by World Health Organization, the ones that they endorse, is $100 a year, which is dramatically different than what we have seen in the past. At one point, regimens in the States were $10,000 a year. And still today, when somebody goes onto what we call a salvage regimen, which is something that is a last-ditch kind of a medication regimen that have, unfortunately, some very highly expensive drugs, that can be $6,000 a year. And so it can get very, very, very expensive.
Do we find that a high percentage of people being treated for HIV are covered by insurance plans?
I think the vast majority of folks really are covered by Ryan White Title Acts. And again, this is something that's outside my area of expertise and really something that we can hit when Sally Neville joins us later on, because she's really an unbelievable wealth of information there. But there is a drug assistance within the States.
Why don't we bring Sally Neville into the conversation? She directs the HIV primary care services at the KC Free Health Clinic. It's nice to have you in the studio this morning.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Build upon what we've been talking about thus far.
I think what Kathy is talking about is that AIDS drug assistance programs are available in the local area, and they're available nationally. And so that most people in the United States who need to be on medication can, in fact, be on medication. Mm-hmm. I think when you look at the global epidemic, it's a little bit different. In fact, I think it's very different. And Kathy and Sarah can probably speak to that more clearly than I can. Medicaid is the largest payer for HIV care in the United States. And then the Ryan White program steps in and fills in those gaps.
Tell us about the Ryan White program.
The Ryan White program, in 1990, the U.S. Congress passed the Ryan White Care Act, which was to provide access to HIV care for those who did not otherwise have access, didn't have a payer source. And it provides for medical care as well as a tremendous range of supportive services that help to identify HIV-positive folks, engage them in care, retain them in care, and help them to adhere to medication. As Kathy mentioned, medication is a form of prevention. Treatment is prevention. And that's one of the pillars of what was talked about at the International AIDS Conference.
You came back from that conference with probably a high level of enthusiasm and some optimism.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
I just want to echo Sarah's comments about the conference. It was an incredible experience to experience the global nature of this epidemic and the passion and commitment that advocates from all over the world have to, as the conference title was, to turn the tide. Mm-hmm. I was also incredibly impressed with the advances that are being made that will help us to reach an AIDS-free generation. And for the first time in a very long time, there is actually a scientific basis to believe that that's actually possible.
You two, Kathy, Sarah, are working on a lot of research projects that speak to addressing the problem, perhaps ending the epidemic at some point in time. Most recently, you did some work in Kenya. Share with some of your takeaways and in the efforts that you were a part of in Kenya.
Okay. Well, in Kenya, we're working actually with a local NGO in Kansas City, Global Health Innovations. The medical director and president of that is a colleague from grad school, Brad Gontney. And he has developed an incredibly innovative technology and an intervention to use to help assist us to improve the services that babies who are born to HIV-positive mothers receive. And the two primary goals of this intervention are to, first, to try to keep these HIV-exposed babies engaged in care. We want to get them tested so that we can determine if they are positive, and if so, get them started on antiretroviral treatment as soon as possible. If we test them negative, we want to help them maintain that negative status through the breastfeeding period. And then after an 18-month period, you know, tested again and determined to be HIV negative, and then just discharged from the program. There's a lot of challenges right now in that system. When we look at the proportion of children who actually get tested, who receive this PCR test to determine their status, about two-thirds of those children get tested. But then when you look at what are the numbers who get that test result back, that test result is communicated to the mother, then you drop down another, perhaps less than two-thirds of that group then get results. By the time this trickles down, for example, in Kenya, you have less than 25% of those infants who are still maintained in this program until 18 months. So we really want to improve the quality of those services, the retention of those services. And so we're working with this intervention developed by Brad Gontney that's called the HIT system. It's the HIV Infant Tracking System. And it's very innovative. It's actually an online system that coordinates communication between the hospital providers, the clinicians, the laboratory where they do the testing and get the test results done, and most importantly, those families, the mothers of those HIV-positive infants. And it's they're using cell phone technology, SMS text messaging. We are able to relay information to those mothers that it's when test results are available to get them back engaged in care. And there's a lot of really innovative aspects of this intervention. We've been piloting it in four settings, four different hospitals in Kenya, and we've had really promising impact. So we're looking at, you know, retention rates that were about 30% before the intervention. Now we're retaining up to 97% of those infants in the program. And when we look at the proportion who are getting treatment, so those HIV-positive kids who are actually getting connected to treatment, we saw that going from about 40% to now 95%.
So, Kathy, how deep do these numbers go, and why Kenya?
Well, so Kenya has a relatively robust epidemic, unfortunately. It's a great place to be actually testing this type of intervention. It has a lot to do with Brad Gottney and where he had connections and where he wanted to start testing this work. But all of sub-Saharan Africa is very high prevalence HIV, and you can pick one of many countries and be doing a lot of good. They're starting in Kenya, moving next to Malawi.
You talk about the problem with infants and mothers, and then it makes it hard for me to wrap my head around why you're so – everyone's so enthusiastic and feels that there's a lot of promise in the fight against HIV and AIDS.
Right. So let me paint a tiny picture of what goes on in sub-Saharan Africa right now.
Prevalence
rates in sub-Saharan Africa are the highest in the world. You look at places like South Africa where 16% of all individuals who are between the ages of 2 and 14 years are HIV positive in two main regions.
What percentage was that again?
16%.
Okay.
You have 100 people lined up, 16 of them between the ages of 2 to 14 are HIV positive. If you line up adults, 18% of them, so 18 out of 100. It's really, 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 really high prevalence. That's contrasted with the States where we have a much smaller epidemic. And these areas have lack of infrastructure issues where there aren't appropriate roads and transport and public transport, and the healthcare system is overburdened. And especially in countries that are, recovering from their colonial and in South Africa, their apartheid history, they have a lot of people who are now needing to be cared for in a system that wasn't originally built to care for them mm-hmm. and is now trying to take on many, many, many more people. With that said, tremendous progress has been made in the last few years where we see many, many more people on medication in sub-Saharan Africa and specifically South Africa. We have work in South Africa. We have work in Uganda. We have work in Kenya and some emerging stuff in some of the other sub-Saharan African countries. But this story is somewhat true for most of sub-Saharan Africa where many more people are getting on to drug. Their drug prices are coming down. The World Health Organization is changing its criteria for getting people onto drug. We used to wait until somebody had 200 CD4 cells, which is just this part of their immune system that indicates how sick they've become, how weakened their body is to attack from other diseases. Because you don't really die from HIV. You die from diseases that you wouldn't have died from before you had HIV. Mm-hmm. Most people in the world are killed by tuberculosis, which they would have been able to fight off, would have been exposed to and carried, like many people, and fought off their whole life. But once they become sufficiently immune compromised from HIV, they die. So 80% of HIV-positive people in the world die from TB. In sub-Saharan Africa, we used to wait until 200 people were down to 200 CD4 cells, quite sick, before we started meds. We've now moved to looking to get people onto meds at 350. This is fantastic. It means much better outcomes. People will live much longer periods of life with much higher quality. The problem is we're having some troubles getting everyone on when we were going for 200 CD4 cells. Now that we've increased the pile of people who need to get on, it's even more stress on an overburdened setting.
Are we poised to beat the AIDS epidemic? AIDS and HIV research and prevention are the topics on Up to Date this morning. Later this hour, a close look at HIV realities in Kansas City. Steve Grasky is away. I'm Bill Anderson. Our guest, Dr. Kathleen Goggin. She's the curator, professor of psychology at UMKC. She directs the HIV/AIDS Research Group in UMKC's Department of Psychology. Also in the studio, Dr. Sarah Finocchiario-Kessler. She's with KU Med Center's Department of Preventive Medicine and Public Health, is a postdoctoral research fellow with the HIV Research Group here at UMKC. And we're also joined in the studio by Sally Neville. She directs the HIV Primary Care Services at the Kansas City Free Health Clinic. We'd like to hear from you. We invite your questions and comments, 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Send an email at uptodate@kcur.org. And of course, we also share your tweets and Facebook comments. Kathy, I want to stay with you. All three of you are so very passionate about this research, and you've been at it a long time. Why? What's the motivation?
I'm not going to speak for anybody else, but I'm old. And I started in HIV in 1984. I grew up in L.A. in the middle of the epidemic and was just raised in one of those families where when, you know, bad things were happening around you, you didn't sit at the dinner table and talk about it. You got out and did something. Mm-hmm. And it kind of wasn't a choice. So I actually volunteered at a hospice when I was 16 and started. Ooh, I just gave away my age. Darn it.
It's okay.
Hopefully people can't do the math.
You're in good company.
Yes. And Sally has amazing stories as well. So does Sarah. So anyway, just that's really what got me started. And I think the primary thing that keeps me going and the reason why the outtake of this International AIDS Conference is so exciting is it's just wrong for us to sit while people die. And we need to actually work our very, very best to see if we can make it a better life for everyone else in the world. So I'll kick it because you guys have been in this as long as I have.
Yes, Sarah.
Thank you. Well, you know, I first started, I think my passion in this was from social justice issues. And it's actually started with looking at the gender inequalities that exist for women, particularly living in low resource parts of the world. And I focused on women's sexual and reproductive health. And when I started, you know, working in this field, you couldn't really look at that without getting involved in HIV. And when I saw the intersection of those two and how gender inequality and other issues that affect women really put them in increased vulnerability for HIV infection, then the two sort of became wed for me. And actually, the work that I do now is really focusing around safer childbearing, where we really look at that intersection of reproductive health and HIV.
Sally, you've been at this since the early 80s.
Yes, I took care of my – I'm a nurse, and mm-hmm. I took care of my first HIV patient in mid-Missouri in 1987. And I was struck with, at that time, the stigma, the discrimination, the incredible amount of personal pain for that individual being HIV, of actually dying from AIDS in the middle of Missouri. And as a nurse, I've always been drawn to kind of the sickest, and that's what I found with HIV. And I've been taking care of HIV patients exclusively since 1990.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other big piece is that there is not a day that goes by when you work with somebody who's HIV positive that you don't get reminded that, you know, you should be treasuring life. It's for a lot of people ask me over the years, just, isn't it sad? And it's like, no, actually, it's by far the most inspiring thing I can think of doing with my time, because folks who are, quote, dying seem to be a lot more alive than a lot of folks who are kind of, you know, meandering through life, worried about day-to-day things. Mm-hmm. It really puts stuff into perspective. I think the other piece that both my colleagues have touched on is this idea of HIV exposes a lot of our societal ills and a lot of our societal uncomfortablenesses, which I'm personally kind of drawn to exposing and talking about. It is not easy to talk about sex. It's not easy to talk about drug use. It's not easy to talk about people who are different than us. But we stay silent at our peril. And HIV really highlights that. And I think the reason the conference is so exciting, being in this as long as I've been in it, is we're really looking at an opportunity with intervention as prevention, which the whole idea behind this is if we can get individuals who are HIV positive to get tested, find out their status, and get onto medication, and they actually can reduce their viral load, stay on medication, reduce their viral load down to an undetectable level, that makes them less infectious. And it means that we still want to promote safer sex. We still want to promote cleaner use of intravenous drug paraphernalia. But it really can reduce the spread of the epidemic. And if we can stamp it out and get it down to very, very low levels, we really can stamp it out entirely. And that, to me, is kind of akin to the protease inhibitors that came out in the early 90s that were like, yay, we finally have a tool where we can actually restore hope and we can restore drive and get going. The other big piece is we have to continually keep people fired up about a topic that's, for many people, they've grown up with.
Mm-hmm.
It's been their whole life. And it's not as sexy as it might have once been when it was all rock stars and, you know, artists and actors. It is now in the mainstream. And it's just a really exciting time to kind of be doing the work. So,
But I think also, and Sarah, you addressed this, I'm sure stigma comes into play, and that's an issue. And I suspect from a public policy standpoint, there are at times obstacles, and then maybe even cultural problems cause us to not be able to attack and get people on a preventive course.
Yeah, and one of the strong takeaways from the conference also was that we really need to address the stigma, and as Hillary Clinton quoted, we need to go where the virus is. And so that is many of these at-risk populations who have been discriminated against, their behaviors criminalized, all of which makes it very difficult to address this in a safe medical using our evidence-based practices.
And I think Elton John said it best at the international conference that HIV causes the disease, but stigma causes the epidemic.
Mm.
And I think we really have to remember that, and mm-hmm. that even after all this time, the stigma is still there. One thing I do want to mention, not only is treatment as prevention, but individuals who are newly diagnosed and get on treatment, really in the United States, and they stay on treatment, really can have almost a normal lifespan. Mm-hmm. It is a completely different epidemic in the United States than it is globally. And it's completely different than what it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago. People who are early diagnosed, get on treatment, stay on treatment, really can, in fact, have almost a normal lifespan.
I hear the stories of people having to take many pills over the course of a day. You were telling me before the show that there is now a single pill that many people are able to take.
Most folks who are newly diagnosed in the United States can, in fact, be on one pill once a day, which makes adhering to medication so much easier. There are a number of other combination pills that are currently in trial to expand that and to make that one pill once a day available for a lot more people.
So those combination drugs are ones that would have multiple drugs within one pill.
Yes.
So we can have all of the classes of antiretrovirals all at one time.
Let's go to the phones. Leslie is calling from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on the air, and good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I've been following, of course, like many people, the budget talks in Washington, and I think a lot of people think that we can solve a lot of our budget problems by cutting foreign aid, but what people don't realize is that it's less than 1% of our budget. And so, you know, although cutting it wouldn't really have much of an impact on helping our deficit, it really does result in the loss of a lot of lives when we're not funding PEPFAR and the Global Fund and other programs that fight AIDS and help people who are victims of AIDS in foreign countries, especially in Africa. And I also wanted to ask the guests, I'm a member of one, and one of our initiatives is to have no child born with HIV by 2015. And I wondered what their opinion was on how feasible that was.
Kathleen?
I'm just going to respond to the first part, and then I'll let my colleagues respond to the second. But I just want to say that you're completely on point. Of course, I'm an HIV researcher, so I very much care about funding to this. But what people don't realize is worldwide, the number one killer of women in their reproductive years is HIV. It's not a small problem, and we ignore it at our peril. And the funding that we have provided and the programs that we've built overseas through the PEPFAR program and some of the USAID programs is just unbelievably changing the lives of folks everywhere. I think it's another one of those conversations of what kind of country do we want to be?
Sarah, would you like to react to Leslie?
Yeah. Hi, Leslie. In regard to this fantastic goal of, you know, eliminating mother-to-child transmission of HIV by 2015, there were some really fantastic presentations at the conference. And I, myself, am optimistic. I think that what we need to do is, you know, if everyone can implement the WHO guidelines, they have these revised guidelines. There's an option A, an option B, and an option B plus. There are three different options that countries can choose for the drug regimens that they want to use for pregnant women, women who come in pregnant and test positive. We are seeing a strong push now to that final option, which is the option B plus. And what that is starting pregnant women on antiretroviral prophylaxis when they are tested, irregardless of their CD4 count. And we don't just keep them on treatment during their pregnancy, but we maintain that treatment throughout their life. And this is really critical, especially in some of the sub-Saharan countries where fertility is also very high. So we may see these women back again for a second or third pregnancy. And so we really want to maintain that treatment. And I think if we can really push for that B-plus option, which they just announced in Uganda when we were there last week, countries are moving toward this. And I think that that will really have a significant impact. Another thing I want to point out is we've made some great progress in certain countries reducing levels of mother-to-child transmission. Where we really need to focus more attention is actually in West Africa, Nigeria. When you look at the proportion of infections and what parts of the country, their world they're coming from, West Africa is an area, particularly Nigeria, we need to really continue to focus on.
Sally Neville, here in Kansas City, do we have the infrastructure to help HIV-positive pregnant mothers? What is in place?
We have an incredible infrastructure. And I think the statistics that Sarah has been giving, it's important to understand that those are the global statistics. In the United States, the mother-to-child transmission has been not totally eliminated, but incredibly, there's an incredible small number of infants born to HIV-positive mothers who turn out to be HIV-positive. In the Kansas City area, we've only had a couple in the last 5, 6, or 7 years. The infrastructure that's in place here is that we have great testing of pregnant women happening, and women who are positive are immediately referred into HIV care through this coordinated, comprehensive system of HIV care that's in place in the Kansas City area.
Is that involuntary testing?
No, it's voluntary.
It's
a routine part of prenatal care,
okay.
And we're certainly encouraging that it become a routine part of all health care. But individuals are informed that they're going to be tested for HIV and can opt out of it if they choose. So the women who are tested and are positive are then immediately referred into care and are started on treatment. And if you're on treatment and you're positive, the chance that your baby is going to be born HIV positive is, I don't have the exact percent, less than 1%. As my colleagues are showing me. So the reduction in maternal child transmission has really been very successful in the United States. And what Sarah and Kathy are working on is making that happen in sub-Saharan Africa.
Sorry, I was just going to say, just to add on, when Sally and I started our work here, it was more like a third of all babies born, and back in the 80s, 90s, and it really is a dramatic change. The trick here is we must actually test them. So back comes in stigma. When folks don't seek prenatal care, don't seek testing, we don't know they're positive, we can't get them on what we call prevention of mother-to-child transmission. An acronym I often have troubles with, so they're both smiling that I got through that. Thank you.
Very impressed.
Thank you. Thank you. I cleaned it up.
Well, Leslie, thanks for your phone call. And Walter's joining us. Walter's calling from Kansas City. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been living in Ghana for the last year. I've been going back and forth since 2003. And people have a tendency of lumping 54 countries that make up a continent together. When you say Africa, a lot of people seem to talk about it like it's a country rather than a continent.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different countries. Ghana's almost 5,000 miles from the east coast of Africa, where Tanzania and Kenya is. A lot of countries in between, a lot of different cultures. In Ghana, they're very open and non-prudish and honest about sexual topics, including AIDS. And to say that the problem is vast in sub-Saharan Africa is not really accurate, because in Ghana, they talk about an infection rate, they say, in Ghana is less than 2%. And I always have the feeling that it's a little higher in the U.S. than it really is in Ghana. I don't know about Nigeria. It's not very far from Ghana, maybe 8 hours by road, and the roads are bad, so it's really pretty close going east. So I don't know the situation in Nigeria, but I'm living in Ghana. They talk about it. Statistics are given out by the government, and it doesn't seem to be the crisis that it is in the U.S. and Ghana, in my opinion. So it's not the whole sub-Saharan Africa that's overrun with AIDS and the problems associated with it.
Walter, you're right on point. It can vary very much just country to country. It just happens that some of the places that have the highest incidence in the world are in sub-Saharan Africa. So South Africa, Lesotho, which is a country that's completely surrounded by South Africa.
Right.
And then Zambia, Namibia. Zambia, down in the bottom part of the continent. But you're right, it's very different. Uganda is another place where the epidemic started hard and fast, and they did a fantastic public health campaign and really reversed the trend of the epidemic there. They then, unfortunately, had some struggled years where they accepted U.S. funds that mandated them to do an abstinence-only approach, and they saw a resurgence in their epidemic, and they are now back to a broader, more mainstream prevention approach now that those dollars are not earmarked to particular types of interventions, and we're seeing improvement again. But you're very right. It varies greatly. And after sub-Saharan Africa comes Eastern Europe and Central Asia, and then the Caribbean. But part of what you're also feeling is just numbers of people do not always equate to the prevalence rates we're citing. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up by saying that it's important that we not only focus on the horror stories. I live in Ghana, and I don't see the things that are reported on the news in that narrow vein in the U.S., like the AIDS epidemic and the starving children and the flies flying around. I haven't seen that since I've been there. I'm not saying it's not there. I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
But there are other positive images there that don't seem to be portrayed in the American media or in the Western media. And another thing, there's one last thing. I've read an article in there's a magazine called Africa Watch, published out of New York by Ghanaians. and with African News and Information. They had a long article detailed in there about South Africa and when the regime changed and how the AIDS epidemic exploded. You can say conspiracy theory, but they were quoting names of South African scientists who were involved in this biological and chemical warfare, or whatever they want to call it, and they seem to connect the dots between certain individuals who were a part of that South African and Rhodesian regime that were instrumental in the explosion of HIV in that area. And it seemed to happen right around the regime change. So that's just my comment.
Well, thanks for your comments, Walter, and your points are well made and well taken. We're going to take a break. When Up to Date returns, we'll talk about efforts, successes, frustrations in the battle against HIV in Kansas City. Your calls, tweets, email, and Facebook messages will be a part of the mix. Steve Kraske is away. I'm Bill Anderson. You're listening to Up to Date. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Bill Anderson. If you missed yesterday's debates about between Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate seat in Missouri and the District 11 State Senate seat in Kansas, you can find those in all our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Now, tomorrow, the Techsperts join us with the latest technology developments and news. Plus, of course, Brian McTavish gives us the weekend to-do list. We're discussing the HIV/AIDS epidemic this morning. We're learning about research, promising inroads, and last week's International AIDS Conference. Bester Samani was diagnosed with AIDS 12 years ago. She's one of 6,000 Kansas Cityans living with HIV. KCUR health reporter Alana Gordon has her story. Let's listen.
In the southern African country of Zambia, there's a phrase people may whisper to each other when someone has or is rumored to have AIDS. Kayonde yonde. Or slimming, slimming. Bester Samani says it's the physical weight loss people there associate with the disease. Samani was unaware of her own physical decline in the spring of 2000. She was too busy wrapping up a year and a half of work studies in hotel management in Kansas City. But she was losing weight, and 2 weeks before she was scheduled to return to Zambia, she wound up in the hospital. Samani says she had no idea why she was so ill until the day before she was to leave. A social worker came in to talk about where she could access AIDS services.
So I'm like, what? You say I have AIDS? She says, yeah, they didn't tell you. I'm like, no. So I demanded that I wanted to talk to the doctor, you know, to find out exactly what was going on. Then the doctor came. He was standing like really far by the door side there. Then he's like, yeah, you have AIDS.
For Samani, the main caretaker of her younger siblings and her daughter, the diagnosis was a huge blow.
It was very, very hard. I think the hardest part was really being a breadwinner for the family. And then to tell them, say, oh no, I have AIDS. I felt like they are pretty much going to have a funeral.
The doctor then told her she'd be able to get medication here that wasn't available in Zambia. Medication that would help her get better, to the point that she'd be able to care for her 6-year-old daughter, Sue. So Samani stayed in Kansas City. Her first challenge of living with the disease came up before she even left the hospital. Staff warned her not to let others know about her diagnosis.
To be told, like, I can't tell anyone. It's more like I've taken a gun and shot someone in the face. You see what I'm saying? Like, I'm the one that has actually caused this problem. Whereas it's supposed to be the other way, like people feel sorry or sympathy for you because you are the one who is sick. But now you are being taken like, you've caused this big problem that you can't even talk about.
Finding support back home wasn't an option either. Not knowing whether the medicine would help, Samani felt that telling her family she had AIDS would be too devastating.
They would be completely hopeless because it's like I'm the person they look up to. You know, they know once she comes back, everything is going to be okay. But now then she knows, oh, she's actually dying. You know, then that's too much pressure on them.
Plus, her whole family would be shunned if people learned she had AIDS. Samani then applied for asylum, based on the hardships she'd face being HIV positive in Zambia. Meanwhile, she got the needed paperwork and funds together to bring her daughter Sue to Kansas City.
I mean, even though she had been gone for, was 3 years or so?
Two years, 8 months.
3 years to me. So even though she had been gone for about 3 years, it was just, she was still my mom.
Despite now having each other, both say life in Kansas City, dealing with HIV, was incredibly isolating.
I didn't even have friends. You know, I didn't have any friends come over or anything like that. We really just didn't have a life.
And it was also really stressful because I was like 7 and then, like, you know, turning 8, and then I can't really talk to anyone about it. And I go to school and I was bullied quite a bit just for being different and for not being from here. And so it was just, I was miserable.
The two found some support. Samani had help from a volunteer with a local AIDS agency. She was also involved in an all-women's HIV support and education group, one that she later assisted with. Sue also found refuge in a week-long camp for kids affected by HIV. But while these outlets were essential for coping, both say they weren't enough. Samani says it wasn't until she confided with someone from Sue's school about her situation, and then others, that she finally found relief.
Life just changed for the better. I mean, it became easier.
Samani says not worrying about keeping the illness to herself gave her more strength and energy. Sue, meanwhile, began talking about it with friends. Then in high school, she joined a group of young adults affected by HIV who traveled to schools around the country to share their experiences.
The only way for me to feel like I could really conquer it, it was by just kind of getting over it and not making it less important, but just kind of getting into a place where it was something, like keeping the secret wouldn't be something that was controlling my life anymore.
That just completed the whole picture, you know. That's when we started having friends over, and now we can talk about it anywhere.
Samani and Sue say it wasn't like everything was immediately okay after they stopped keeping HIV a secret. The stress from the disease and from having enough resources to survive has had a huge physical and psychological toll. But this May, Sue completed her first year at Columbia University on a full scholarship. The two were also recently granted U.S. citizenship. And with that, they finally had the chance to take a trip home to Zambia. Samani gets the impression the climate and stigma around HIV in Zambia has changed a lot since she was first diagnosed with the disease 12 years ago.
Because so many people are sick. So almost every household, maybe they have someone who has AIDS. So it really doesn't make sense, like, one family to be pointing fingers at the other family when they are dealing with it in their own family. You know, it's so commonplace now that people are more accepting.
Samani says life in Kansas City continues to have ups and downs. She's unemployed right now, but wants to put her talents and skills in hotel management to work. A problem with her right hip makes it difficult to walk sometimes, and she's struggling to find treatment. Even so, Samani says she has faith things will work out the way they're supposed to.
And so I never lose hope. I know that I'm sick right now. It's just one of those challenges that I have to go through. I know that it's gonna pass, and I know that I've got many more years of bright future ahead of me.
Samani is spending her days applying for jobs, meeting with women in her HIV support group, and enjoying the time she has with Sue while she's home from college on summer break. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
That piece aired on KC Currents in a longer form. The entire piece is archived at kcur.org. We're shifting our conversation to a look at the state of the HIV-AIDS epidemic in Kansas City. Sally Neville directs HIV primary care services at the KC Free Health Clinic. She directs the Midwest AIDS Training Education Center. I want to hear your reaction to hearing what I thought was a pretty powerful piece.
Oh, it absolutely was powerful. And it every day I am touched and I'm changed by the stories of those folks who are living with HIV and the courage and the power of their lives. And I think that this particular story highlights the services that are available in Kansas City and the infrastructure that's here to help those who are living with HIV to live well with HIV.
What broke my heart was the fact that she was so stigmatized that she internalized all this.
Absolutely.
And it led to depression. And that has to be an incredible negative when you're trying to fight a potentially...
Absolutely. The struggles that people living with HIV have to overcome the stigma associated with that diagnosis and to move forward with it, it's inspiring to me. And I'm really grateful that I have a chance in some small way to be a part of that.
Dr. Sarah Finocchiaro Kessler is of the KU Med Center Department of Family Medicine. She's also a fellow of the HIV Research Group at UMKC. The story ends up, there's hope. There's a lot of hope at the end of this piece. And what I'm hearing from the three of you today is that there is a lot of promise in people that are HIV positive in 2012 can live healthy, creative, wonderful lives.
Yes, it really is inspiring. And I think that one example of that is some of the work that I do with women living with HIV in regard to their plans to continue with their families. And you have to remember, a lot of these young women in the United States are being infected in adolescence or in young adulthood before they've started or completed their families. And prior, you know, given the more dismal outlook of the disease, many people didn't feel that that was an option for them or that, that was closed to them. But it's really shifted now, and especially with the advances in treatment and prevention, this is, you know, it is an option to have a child who's HIV-free. And many of the women that I've worked with in Baltimore really have that as an aspiration. And not just women. We need to remember that many men, it's very important to them as well, this ability to live a healthy life, continue to have a family.
Well, which raises another question for Sally. There are a couple of communities in Kansas City that are probably more at risk than others?
Yes. In Kansas City, as well as in most of the United States, the HIV epidemic really does remain a disease of men who have sex with men. And in Kansas City, that remains true. And in fact, what we are finding very alarmingly is that among young minority men who have sex with men, the HIV rates are dramatically increasing. Just from January through June of this year, of the 83 newly diagnosed folks identified in the Kansas City metropolitan area, of the 83 men, 25% of those are young men ages 13 to 24. Who are, by the vast majority, a minority. And so that's a community where prevention efforts are really concentrated, and the efforts to identify, engage, and empower those folks to live well with HIV are really underway. We're fortunate in that the Kansas City community has access to a CDC-funded prevention program for minority men who have sex with men. The clinic is the lead agency for this, and we're working with Good Samaritan Project, as well as others, really focusing prevention efforts on that particular community because of the high risk of that particular community.
We're glad you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Bill Anderson, and we're having a conversation about HIV and AIDS in Kansas City. Are we poised to beat the AIDS epidemic? We'd like to hear from you at 235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Of course, email reaches us at uptodate@kcur.org. You can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. One more question for you. How accessible is medication in the Kansas City area?
Again, we are very fortunate in the service delivery system that we have in Kansas City. Medicaid, as I mentioned, is the largest provider of HIV services. But for those who do not have access to Medicaid, Medicare, or third-party insurance, the Ryan White program steps in. And one of the largest programs that they have are AIDS drug assistance programs, which are run by each state. And both in Kansas and Missouri, AIDS drugs are available to those individuals who do not have a third-party payer source. That's not true in many parts of the country. There are waiting lists for AIDS drugs in a number of states in the United States. So we're very fortunate that the local programs are well managed and are robust and able to provide access to medications. because, again, treatment is prevention. Every new infection starts with an old infection. And if you can reduce the virus that's traveling in a person's body, they are much less likely to be infectious to other people.
Dr. Kathleen Goggin, in your research, you pursued some alternative therapies, or at least looked at that in South Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So we were very interested, and this is a collaborative grant with the University of Missouri, Columbia, as well as the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa, and funded by the National Institutes of Health. And the work really primarily is about the reality of HIV in South Africa. And about 70% of Africans will seek the help of a traditional healer at some point during their life, and many of them will never make it to more Western-styled care unless they are engaged or unless the healer suggests that they go there. And many of the healers see people who are early infected with HIV. So healers are folks like medicine people here in the States, or shaman, or in our Native American culture, or they give herbs and they do faith healings and all sorts of different types of things. My work really centered on trying to get the traditional healer world to talk to the Western trained mm-hmm. medical world, because in between the chasm between those two worlds, many people died. Mm-hmm. Lots of folks would have symptoms, symptoms of a sexually transmitted disease, see the local traditional healer because they're so much more accessible to them in their village and cheaper and easier to get to, and then never really go and get tested for HIV. And so we actually looked at some of the treatments that the traditional healers use, a particular herb that they use, and ran a hardcore Western-styled randomized clinical trial on an herb called Sutherlandia or Umwelle. And those results will be released in August. We're just about to release our findings from that trial. So I can tell you that it went well, and we have the first trial in the world in sub-Saharan Africa that actually studied a local botanical that's used in early-stage HIV to treat gastrointestinal distress and STIs.
Kathy Goggin is curator's professor of psychology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and director of the HIV-AIDS Research Group. Sally Neville is director of HIV primary care at Kansas City's Free Health Clinic. Dr. Finicario Kessler is with KU Med Center's Department of Family Medicine. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Learn more about our guest and get more information about our show at kcur.org. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, the Techsperts bring us the latest technology news, and Brian McTavish has the weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. In for Steve Kraske, I'm Bill Anderson, and you are up to date.